Morning, everyone. This is Brandon with the Iowa Healthcare Association. This is our Amerigroup MCO call for February 9th, 2022. For 2022, our MCO calls have been sponsored by Right Dose, a Guardian pharmacy. Right Dose has been a major player and a great partner of the Iowa Healthcare Association for many years now, and I've decided to jump on board with the sponsoring the MCO calls for this year. And so we appreciate working with them and their sponsorship of these calls going forward. If you're needing pharmacy services, that could be an option for you to explore. We'll go into our informational letters like we do at the top of all of our calls. Have three that we want to briefly touch on here today. The first one being we had one of them being informational letter 2308, which is the EVV transition. So this is obviously as a result of the Cures Act, transitioning home health services to EVV effective 1/1/23. And so the department, in conjunction with the managed care organizations, have begun the process of setting up some provider training sessions and stakeholder meetings for the first part of 2022 here. Those two meetings in April and May allow you to register for them and provide any feedback. But wanting to get a jump start on this, as this will obviously be a significant change. Obviously, we already are also in EVV for our personal care services, but this would be all of our home health services that will be making that transition on 1/1/23. And so wanted to make sure that IL 2308 was on your radar as an opportunity for you to join in the meeting of stakeholders to provide some feedback. So that is out there. IL 2309, which is the HCBS ARPA Recruitment Retention Grant informational letter. So this is funding available to HCBS providers for the recruitment and retention of employees. And so what you're basically doing is there's a form here, and it's specific, I think, at least for our provider types. Mostly agency CDAC providers would be those of our members who are likely qualifying for this grant. But you're filling out a form in that informational letter 2309 that will allow you to indicate how many employees you have, indicate how many open positions you have, and then you would receive some grant monies to help retain the workers you have and recruit for the open positions that you have. And so it's a pretty simple form that you can fill out. The date that is due back by is February 18th. And so wanting to make sure that you get that in, it is a pretty simple form to do. So I would make sure that you get that in. You could even look at the form ahead of time if you'd like to be able to review it and make sure you have all the information prior to submission. And so I would recommend that. I think it sounds like they're trying to get out about $50 million to providers for this recruitment and retention. And so estimates that I had seen indicate about $2,500 for each of those efforts per employee. So recruitment and retention. And that's obviously just based on an estimate. So obviously if they have a large uptake of providers wanting to do this, it could be less. If they have fewer providers and employees applying for this grant, it could be more. So just wanted to flag that one as well. And then the last informational letter is on the Rebuild Iowa Infrastructure Fund. It is 2302. And that info letter is basically notification to nursing facility providers of those funds that are available for those providers who have undergone a complete renovation or reconstruction of a facility in excess of $1.5 million. It would make you or would allow you to request some additional funding to offset some of those building costs. It's through the RIF fund. There are several different requirements for being able to qualify for those funds. One, and I know one that's been a bigger struggle here as of recent, it is the requirement that 40% of your licensed capacity be Medicaid. And so if you have 100 beds in your facility, 40 of those 40 individuals would need to be on Medicaid to qualify for the program, even if you only have 60 residents, 40 of them still need to be Medicaid. And that's been one of the major problems that providers are currently experiencing, is not being able to meet that threshold. There is a process to be able to request the funding by not meeting that. It's obviously, it would be through the exception to policy program. If you have any questions though, and you think that you may qualify, or what you're not thinking you're going to meet the criteria, we can help at the association guide you to maybe be able to request and receive some of those funds. So just wanted to point that out. IL 2302 is on the RIF program and requesting those funds. There was a deadline on that as well. 60 days from January 18th. So we're looking mid-March for those applications to be in. So just wanted to point that out. That covers my informational letter update that we want to talk about each month. I'm going to turn it over to John to see if John or anyone from his team have any general updates they'd like to make prior to going into questions.
Hey, good morning, everyone, and thank you, Brandon and Julie, for inviting the Amerigroup team on. I just want to acknowledge and confirm that we've got Cherie Smith-Martinez, Megan Lemereau, and Daniel Kratis on joining us, along with Donna Wendt. There may be others, and I'll continue to scroll through. Oh, Angela Dillon as well, from the UM side, on the physical health side of our shop. So a number of folks, we did have a chance to do a scan on the questions that we got yesterday or the day before, and have some responses, and look forward to entertaining questions in the chat that cascade from the conversation today. Just wanted to highlight that the Medicaid program is still operating under the federal and state public health proclamations. We have not received any further messaging or guidance with regard to the governor's announcement last year with regard to the state public health declaration, and are looking forward to getting some more detail and clarity on that in the coming days and weeks, setting up the process of the state plan amendments that the state submitted to the CMS that were approved, that created some of the flexibility within Medicaid, was a process. And I think that we can all expect that unwinding all of that and returning eventually to a normal state of application and administration of Medicaid will take similarly long and deliberate process. So look to the IME for messaging about that, and that will cascade through the MCOs appropriately. So I'm sure more to come on that. Excuse me for my frog. Give me a second. Next is, you know, we're experiencing a lot of COVID-related operational issues and clinical issues with our members and the providers that support members and you are as well. So we're tracking very closely that. It is the dominant frame of reference and context for administering health programs right now, including Medicaid. Moving forward, it's some of the things to look forward to. And in 2022, the state of Iowa Medicaid has required the MCOs to draft a health equity plan and start implementing toward health disparities in 2022, beginning in July 1st, and moving into a three-year cadence on that. The degree to which providers will be impacted will be dependent on the degree to which providers are serving individuals who are Medicaid members experiencing significant health disparities. And there is a rural and urban cut to all of that. And I spent some time with our team talking with a number of different other teams, including the Iowa Healthcare Association. I want to thank Brandon for joining in that conversation and providing us with a little more context about the headwinds that providers are facing in providing care in rural areas. And we're thinking in terms of what payers, what an MCO can do in partnership with a lot of different entities, including providers, to address the divide in rural healthcare as compared to urban healthcare. So more to come on that. That is a process. There, as you know, are no silver bullets in resolving issues like healthcare staffing, the unavailability of direct care workers in many areas, and difficulty in retaining staff, and of course, the impact that COVID is having on all of those. So I'm happy to be joined in conversation about that. With that, Brandon, I don't have any other specific updates as it relates to Amerigroup today. I did want to kick it over, maybe check in with Cherie and Danielle to see if they had any updates from a provider experience standpoint.
John, this is Cherie. I don't have any specific updates today, but I could answer the question that are already in the chat, if you would like me to proceed with that.
Yeah, let's go into the pre-submitted questions, and then get into the questions in the chat. I do want to note here, we wanted to get to the home health aid questions first because Donna Wendt has something that she wanted to share, but she's having computer issues and is rebooting right now. I'm just checking our team's messaging to see where that status is. So why don't we go into the pre-submitted questions, and when I see Donna get back.
So we'll look into those pre-submitted questions. We'll wait on the home health aid one until Donna is able to get back on. But I know one that was submitted ahead of time that I'm pretty sure based on, I know I got a response from you, John, yesterday about it, was the EA4 denial being, have claims with the EA4 denial been reprocessed by Amerigroup as stated on the call last month? And I know you'd made a comment about that, so I figured that might be one that we can easily address here quick while we're waiting for Donna to join.
Sorry, I took myself on mute and I was over on the other screen that had the had the information that I wanted to share. So yeah, so I'll post this in the chat, the link to the configuration report that we posted. Note that the straight up answer is March 3rd is when all those claims will be reprocessed. We had a configuration project go into place in begin in January, is completed now and are scheduled to be reprocessed on March 3rd. And I'll drop that link into the chat so everybody can see that and you can pick it up and send it out as needed, Brandon.
Awesome. Thanks, John. So I know I did see a question in the chat about the EA4 denial, or it was specific. That was one of the comments within there. And so I think this would get at part of that question from Cindy is the fourth, or the third, I guess, I think is what you'd mentioned for those claims for processing. And that was a pre-submitted question too on when those, we expect those to reprocess. I do know some providers that have received those denials have gone the appeal route on their claims and have started to see those reprocess as well. Ahead of that March 2nd deadline, or March 2nd expected claims transition timeframe. So I guess that's another option for you if you decide to go that route. Another question that we had ahead of time was expectations from transportation providers. I know we talked about this a little bit earlier at our 10:30 call, but wanted to get the perspective of Amerigroup as well when it comes to transportation providers and either potentially no call, no showing for a ride that they had scheduled ahead of time, or showing up significantly late to where an Amerigroup member misses their appointment timeframe, and just some thoughts, I guess, from Amerigroup on their partnership with their transportation vendor.
Yeah, and we have the same transportation vendor as Iowa Total Care, so this may be a bit of a repeat. But two quick things, and then a resource. If you've got questions about access to care, for sure reach out to your provider experience representative. If you have real-time issues, no-show, for example, you may contact Access to Care directly, and I'll provide you with an 800 number and an email to be able to do that. Stepping back and contextually, we have, and Iowa Medicaid and Iowa Total Care have several corrective action plans in place with Access to Care to address some of the issues that we've seen in terms of lates and no-shows by transportation subcontractors that subcontract with Access to Care. And they have noted some of the headwinds in terms of the impact of COVID on drivers and the difficulty in fulfilling appointments when that has struck. We have asked them to develop workarounds on that. And so that is an ongoing project. Just before this meeting, I was provided with an updated contact information and FAQ sheet, a frequently asked question sheet, Brandon, and I sent that to you and Julie so that you may cascade that to all of the providers as needed. And from that, I will post in the chat the 800 number and the email address that providers can contact if they have real-time issues, scheduling issues that are occurring with the folks they're serving. Hopefully I said exactly the same thing that Iowa Total Care said.
Yeah, I think so. As you put that number in the chat, we do have a number from earlier, and so hopefully they're the same resource since they are the same vendor, I suppose. So, had Donna been able to join us again yet? Doesn't look like it.
She had to literally completely take down and reboot about 2 minutes after the meeting started.
Okay.
So I'll look for a text from her.
All right, that's fine. And I suppose if we don't have another team member that can take that one, we can maybe flip into the chat and go through some of there, since I know Cherie had mentioned that I think she has some feedback for some of the questions that are submitted through there. So.
You bet. And Danielle, I would ask also, Danielle, if you have any perspective on the home health aid auth question that was pre-submitted, go ahead and chime in now.
Thank you. I don't have anything additional than what Donna will be adding.
So as far as the questions in the chat, we'll kind of flip through those here quick, hopefully. The first one is, it sounds like we've had some issues with recoupments coming back for money that had been 3 years in this case. And I've heard of even situations where it's almost 5 years, 4.5 years in arrears. And I know we've talked about this, but there are also situations where, well, I guess I'll pause there. Is there an opportunity if there was a recoupment done 3 years ago, recouping funds that had maybe been paid incorrectly, does the provider have an opportunity at that point to correct the claim or make some kind of a correction to that recoupment?
Brandon, this is Cherie, and yes, the provider can submit a corrected claim, but let me back up and outline a couple things so that they have all the information about that recoupment process. So recoupments, per the contract with the state of Iowa, recoupments have a 5-year reach back. So it's not unheard of for there to be claims, you know, as old as 5 years old, because that's what the, you know, the reach back time is. And Amerigroup, of course, per their contract would have an obligation to recoup any funds that were paid incorrectly, you know, per what the plan, you know, per what are payable in the plan. So for that's the first piece on the time span. Then if they've submitted a corrected claim and they've been paid and now we are attempting to recoup, they would submit a corrected claim. And you would submit that in the regular system, make sure it's corrected. And then when you have the corrected claim number, you would want to let your recoup, you know, along with filing your appeal with the recoupment or the dispute in the recoupment process, which is listed in the letter that you receive, you would attach that you also have filed that corrected claim. And then you also will probably want to reach out to your rep and, you know, go through the process with them, because one of two things happen. Either the whole process will just be reshuffled because of the corrected claim, or they will do a take back and then they will pay on the corrected claim. So it depends on which one of those happens. But if they do a take back and then they pay on the corrected claim is going to be denied for timely filing, because that's what the system would do. So you would need your rep to help you with getting that reprocessed. And so that, you know, that would be the process. Further down, there was some comments about recoupment further down in the chat. And I think there was some reference to that you cannot file a recoupment, you know, to the same place that you provide, that you send your provider appeals. And that is a correct. However, I think just in the last couple of weeks, we have come to the awareness that the process of implementing and may be in place already in availability, that you can do your appeals for recoupment or your disputes for recoupment through availability. So it would be in one of those drop downs, you would select that. If you're not finding that now, it will be coming, and we will clarify and get confirmation that that's actually in place. And that will simplify things a lot. However, the directions currently, there's directions on your letter, and then also on the letter should be a contact person and a phone number if you need to make phone calls to recoupment to ask any questions.
Thanks, Cherie. I guess one follow-up that I would have to that is, I know the initial timely filing limitations are 180 days. And then I was of the understanding that you would have 365 from the most recent kind of adjustment to a claim. And so if a claim is having amounts recouped off of it, that would be kind of like what I would consider a touch on the claim that would then open it back up for that 365 window to be able to make a correction to it. Is that accurate in my thought process? Yeah. Or?
I'm not sure that we have that in print in the process that you've described, but theoretically that is correct. And we if a provider is being recouped and the claim will pay with a corrected claim, you know, due to a billing error, then we will handle that and make sure that, you know, they either don't get recouped or they will still get recouped because the claim that's on file is incorrect, but then we will reprocess the corrected claim.
Okay. And I do, I mean, as I'm flipping through here, another comment or question is just the volume of denials being received, whether being saying no authorizations on file, even though an authorization has been received, going through that dispute process and submitting all the proper information to show that an auth has been received, and then that denial being upheld makes it difficult. And I don't know if there's any, I know it sounds like several providers are having the same problems. I know you just talked about Ability having a dispute process, which I guess the hope is that that is more effective at appropriately noticing that the recoupment was an error based off of the information that we're able to submit to prove that. I don't know if you have any other comments based off of, I guess, that feedback that we have from the provider.
If a provider does a dispute and they still believe that it's, you know, incorrect, and, you know, the dispute, and I'm talking about a dispute related to a recoupment, the best process is to reach out to your rep and have your rep go through it with you. And then once they go through it, if everyone thinks, yep, this is an error, then there is a system that the rep can send that back through and say, can you look at this again? And so, you know, if we've done it in error, and when it's being reviewed, you know, per the dispute process, they still don't get the logic correct, then we have a mechanism to correct that. And so, again, work with your rep on those issues, and, you know, you'll be fine. But the initial disputes, you know, send those directly to the recoupment team, you know, per the information on the letter, or as I indicated, you know, there will be the availability to use Availity to do those disputes.
And will that be the same? Is that the same process if a claim we feel was inappropriately denied?
If a claim was inappropriately denied, the first steps would be to use the front end processes to resolve those. And the front end processes would, what we'd be talking about would be the reconsideration and the appeal process. Both of those can be done within Availity. And then the reconsideration process can also be done by telephone, by just calling to provider services. And, you know, they can, over the phone, they'll do a certain number of claims, you know, all in one call in a reconsideration process. And so you would want to exercise those two steps, you know, to dispute the underpayment or the denial. And then if you don't have success there, then again, reach out to your rep, and then your rep will help you with an escalation process to get those resolved. So the goal here is that our front end processes are utilized, and that, you know, we've done a lot, you know, it's been a long year of a lot of changes, and all of our changes have been geared towards, you know, enhancing the processes and making the processes work. But we would like to be able to switch and get our claims resolved in those front end processes, which are very quick and are, you know, to resolve the processes, where when you get into escalation, then they kind of drag on because the volume is very large, you know, and we really only want like complex issues that can't be resolved in those front end processes. Our goal is to have only those types of claims in that, you know, the back end. So first step, reach out, you know, do those two processes, and then reach out to your rep if you still cannot get those resolved. And, you know, if you're getting repeat denials, and I would echo this for the recoupment, if you're getting repeat denials, you know, you also need to reach out to your rep and work with them to get to a root cause. And in our changes and that we've have in the system, in our escalation process, if the rep can't identify what it is that's causing, you know, the repeat denials, that just keep going on and on, and that a provider would have to be, you know, having the claims reprocessed or disputing them continuously, then what we can put them into the escalation system, and we have analysts in that system that can do the analysis and identify the root cause. So we've implemented a lot of new stuff, and I would say very heavily in the last 6 months. You know, so it's not perfect at this point, but it's working really well. And, you know, we still have more to do and, you know, more to go. But I think that providers, if they utilize the processes as we intend them, are going to see that they're working for them.
Thanks, Sheree. You know, I think a couple comments based off of your response here. I think I'm glad I asked the question about difference between denials and recoupments, because it definitely sounds like there's a different process, reconsideration versus dispute versus appeal. It's hard in my head, I know, to keep in order what process follows which scenario, when in my head I'm just like, this was processed wrong. And whether it's not paid because it was denied, or not paid because it was paid the wrong amount, or funds going back, I guess in my head, it's an error, I suppose. And so I wasn't clear on which piece followed which scenario. And so I'm glad you went into some detail on that, and I appreciate that. As far as you'd mentioned a process on repeat denials, and I know within the chat we've got some several pieces of feedback about denials for not having an auth, because that's been an ongoing issue for our home health providers specifically, and part of why, or not having an auth, but or not also not having an EOB is a big one. And I know we've had processes put in place to where we're putting the Z76.89 diagnosis code on our home health claims. I know we had in the past done that XB not homebound indicator in the comments box. Some leave both on there currently. And so I guess I would have a hard time thinking that those haven't been reviewed or brought to those claims analysts, or those analysts that you'd mentioned, to come up with a solution as to why those are being denied, when we're having the proper information on the claim when it's submitted the first time. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that specifically, and maybe why those are still denying.
Sure. So we're referencing this next one, right? That's talking about getting denials with the authorizations.
Yeah, probably. I was just kind of talking about just the scenarios, and yeah, it'd be the next one.
Right. So, let me clarify that there's lots of different reasons that, claims will deny, and sometimes human error can be one of the reasons, obviously. But each denial has its own unique things that could, be causing it when the provider believes it's an incorrect denial. So for this example that's in the chat with the authorizations, if a provider came to me and said, gee, I have this problem, I keep getting denied for no auths, but I have authorizations and I don't really see why this is happening. I would go and I would be looking at their network rows in our system, and I would be looking to make sure that the auth was on the correct set of network rows, because many times many of the providers will have multiple sets of network rows. And so they might have an authorization, but if it isn't on the line of the network rows where the claim pays, that could be a reason to get that denial. The other thing could be that the authorization is in the right place, but the claim jumps and it hits a different set of network rows. And maybe that network row, sometimes providers will have multiple network rows, and some of them will be par and some of them will be non-par, and there'll be, extra records that aren't being used. And when they're non-par, sometimes claims will jump down and they will hit those non-par records. And so then it will look like the provider's out of network. So then it will, you'll have a problem with this, getting this denial code of an no authorization. So when you have these and it's being ongoing like this, the best thing to do is to reach out to your rep, and you have to get to a root cause, and then we can reprocess the claims. Root cause, if you've got an ongoing problem, is always the issue. And as I said a little bit earlier, in the last 6 months, we've implemented a lot of new processes, and one of them is in our new Interact system that, pulls all of our different teams together to the same place to be able to communicate and look at different things. And we do have a root cause analysis built in there. So they literally, if the rep can't figure it out, they can put it into this system and have an analysis done and get the feedback back. So then whatever needs to be corrected on the record so that the claims process cleanly and providers are not needing to repeat, and do extra work to be able to get paid, we get that cleaned up and then we can reprocess the claims.
Thanks, Cherie. Is the network rows terminology, is that something that all provider reps would have, I guess, knowledge of? Like if we were to make reference to that in our conversation with our representative or our provider experience rep, is that something that they would all understand? So we were just like, verify that our network row, I think, I don't know if you can put that in the chat as to what that is. So that way we can at least be talking their language to try to trigger something that may shake something loose for us, I suppose.
Sure. Your network row is just an informational line that, you know, contains demographic information. So, you know, when you put information into a claim form, it has to come in and hit something, you know, in an electronic system. And so it hits, you know, those network row, the information that's in the network row. So, you know, you've got your TINs, NPIs, addresses. I mean, all of that, you know, is part of, you know, that process of the network row. And each provider has what's called a provider number. We refer to it frequently as a PRPR number. And at the top of your EOBs, you should be able to see that number. And that will tell you what, you know, like what network row those claims paid on. So, you know, sometimes when providers have multiple sites, sometimes when providers have been, you know, sold and, you know, they retain the same 10 as before. And there's just so many different scenarios that could cause a provider to have, you know, multiple network rows. But if you're getting denials, you know, for no auth, you know, that's based on that either you failed to get an authorization. But in this case, they're saying they have the authorizations. So if they have the authorizations, you know, my first look would be, you know, to see where the what network row the authorizations are located on. And then to look at, is the claim hitting a line that considers them to be, you know, out of network? And then there's no authorization on that line. So they're getting a denial as if they're out of network, which is, you know, no auth, because if you're out of network, you're required to have a pre-authorization. I know that's a lot of information. I hope that isn't convoluted.
Thanks, Sheree. I do have a question in here on EVV for home health for 1123. And that would be for, yes, your skilled nursing home health aide. I want to say MSW, PTOT, speech. Julie from our team, is that, did I state them all? Or did I miss any?
Nope, you're good.
Okay, so it's all those services, 1123. All right, flipping through the chat here. This question, I think, from Peyton is about the claims rejecting for invalid HIPS codes. I don't think that this is the same thing as the EA4. I kind of get them confused every once in a while. But any update as far as the HIPS code rejections that some providers are receiving? They indicated a project had been done. Peyton's wondering, it hasn't been confirmed if their facility was included in that. Any thoughts from anyone in the Merit Group?
This is Sheree. I see Ben's name in there. Ben is one of our reps. So I would recommend that the provider reach back out. Oftentimes, we can get information about who's included in a project. Sometimes, depending upon the project, we get that information up front. But if the provider wants to know if their, you know, if their claims are being addressed by the project, that would be done through the rep.
Awesome. When CP is updated retroactively for long-term care residents, is Amerigroup still automatically pulling those rates from IME and reprocessing?
Okay, let's see.
Would it be a retro CP change? Are those automatically adjusted then by Amerigroup?
This is Sheree again. When there's a retroactive client participation, we did just do a big project where they caught all those up. I am not clear if we will be doing that on an ongoing basis, but there was a large backlog between the state and the MCOs on the client participation. So I know that there was a project recently where we did on all those retros, we did go through and reprocess. So that's something I'll take back to clarify if that will be an ongoing process or if that will be something that when the provider gets notice, you know, that something has been done retroactively, if they'll need to adjust the claim. So one of the other things I just wanted to point out of this, and it, clearly that person who is asking the question has a claim where their reimbursement probably was increased. So the retro, you know, reimbursement. But sometimes the client, the amount of the client participation goes up. And when the amount of the client participation goes up, then the amount of the claim that should have been paid goes down. And then those can end up in a recruitment process if the provider does not do a voluntary payback on those.
Yep. No, I would agree with that. It seems like, you know, obviously retroactive client participation adjustments are happening all the time. There's not like a singular time frame in which all those occur. It's usually because of some kind of notification to the department that either income has increased and they need to make that change retroactively, or a potential source of income has no longer or has gone away, and those CPs would then need to come down. So I think it'll just be an ongoing piece. And so I think when you mentioned you're going to seek some additional clarification on that, I think that would be helpful. Next one's another one about the HIPS codes, and this is jogging my memory, so thanks, Angela, about the denials are received when the individual has both, at least in their case, Amerigroup's Medicare Advantage plan, and they're on Medicaid. In this case, I think in most of these cases, the provider is billing for the Medicaid portion only and receiving a denial on because of them having the AmeriVantage plan. And so I know you'd mentioned a project in the works. It sounds like this provider has had a year's worth of claims not being paid, and so obviously would like to receive some of those funds for services that have been provided almost a year ago. I don't know if you have any other thoughts or comments on that HIPS based off of that comment.
We do have a project and on that issue, and I think there's a couple of different things that are going on there since the AmeriVantage plan, and that one of the things is a Medicaid claim just crossing over, you know, to the Medicare and then getting a Medicare number and denying, even though it was a Medicaid. So, you know, we have activity and projects going on that. And then the other piece that you're talking about, if, you know, the primary payer, if they're not the primary payer, then there would just be, you can put those into the dispute process. And my advice would be to just use the phone and call, because they can reprocess those immediately. Because clearly, if it's not a covered service by Medicare, then we would be paying for that. But we do have projects on that, and we do have, and I apologize because, we'll bring an update to you, but we do also have some reconfiguration stuff going on to make sure that those claims are coming through clean and getting paid, and that, you know, we don't have any entanglement between the two plans.
Awesome. This next one from Peyton is about we have a large number of RHC and CAH, which if I had to guess, I'd say rural health clinic and critical access hospital claims processing as primary, when Amerigroup is secondary and the primary payment information is on the claim. Is this a known issue?
Okay.
I don't know if this is part of your field or not, Sheree.
I guess I would tell you very honestly, I think I'd need more information to be able to answer that. But that's one that I'll take under advisement and get back to you. I'm making a copy of all these questions at the end.
Okay.
But I can follow up on that one.
Sounds good. Thank you. This one's on EVV for CareBridge. Where do we do the correction after there is a billing error in CareBridge? They contacted CareBridge and they said to contact Amerigroup, but when we contact Amerigroup, Amerigroup said to contact and fix it through CareBridge. So I guess what is the proper route for correcting a claim that has errors when they're paid through CareBridge?
Okay, they do that, you know, on the device. I don't know the process off the top of my head, but that's another one that we'll get that detail for you and we'll bring that back.
Okay, thank you. just reading the questions. So sorry for my pause.
That's all right. I did drop in a written response that Donna provided ahead of time on the question that you submitted regarding home health aid.
Oh, great. I don't know, I haven't got there yet, but the question was, there are situations, or I've heard from providers, where home health aid services are almost capped at 14 or 16 visits a month, and they're not being paid for anything beyond that. So the question was, is there a maximum on the number of home health aid visits in a month? And then just a comment about the service not requiring authorization. And I'll scroll down.
She references a differentiation and notes that we don't require prior auth, but there's a couple of informational letters that IME has put out with some clarification that references their need to do some clarifying administrative rules.
Okay, so it sounds like potentially what the hiccup may be with those home health aid visits is, one, the limitation on 28 hours per week, that says per week, and then the expected number of hours that the department thinks a home health aid visit would be. And it mentions anywhere between 0 and 2 hours. And so if there was some kind of insertion of 28 visits taking 2 hours apiece, that could be a 14 visit. I won't use the word limit, but threshold. If the visits are taking that long. I do think that there probably needs to be some additional clarification. It does say 28 hours per week, where I think that there's been, these are monthly. So the number of visits would far exceed 14. If that's part of the determination on numbers that you're talking about. I don't know if, Julie, do you have any initial thoughts on that, I guess, as I talk about that?
No, but even at 28 hours a week, even if they were doing 2 visits a day, you'd be at 14 visits a week. They're probably not hitting that. So it would be an incorrect denial, first of all, right out of the gate. Second of all, 0 is not a limit you'd ever have in. If you're doing a visit, you wouldn't ever have 0 hours. But 28 hours, unless it's a quad, will probably cover most visits, even at twice a day. So I'm not sure why the cap would be saying that, because they're not hitting 28 hours a week in 14 visits.
And I think it sounds like, at least from the question that I got, they're capped at like 14 to 16 a month, which would obviously be very
way less.
And I know you mentioned there probably needs to be additional questions or thought given to that process, John. It sounds like we had someone else who maybe had a comment.
This is Carrie, and I'm actually the one that's been having the problem. I'm with the Skyline Center. I've been having this problem since March. And it's visits. It's not hours. G0156 is a visit code. It's not a unit. It's not an hour. It doesn't happen on every client, but 95% of our clients are being only paid 14 or 16 visits. I've talked to my rep over and over again. I've emailed. It's something that needs to be looked into, because it's a lot of revenue that we're missing out on since March.
I guess a question Thanks. Thank you for the additional feedback there. A question I might have of any other home health agency member, is anyone else experiencing some kind of a limit on the number of aid visits? If you wouldn't mind at least making some comment in the chat, I suppose, yes or no, on what your experience has been, or if we can maybe try to determine if this is an isolated type issue, I think that could be helpful, at least from, I think, from America's perspective on determining the scope of the problem.
Yeah, that would be helpful. I just note in Donna's response, she has not heard of this being an issue. So, and also in her response, she quotes an IL from IME that lays out the visit and counter of 0 to 2 hours. So, you know, we may need some clarification from the department on this as well.
Because as of right now, until you go to EVV, it's not even an hour issue or unit. G0156 is per visit. And there is no max, and there is no prior authorization for Amerigroup.
Hey, Brandon, it's Julie. I think we'll take that particular question back to IME as well, and I can clarify with them the language.
Thanks, Julie. Sorry, I'm reading through the chat as well. This is another question that's related to that CP issue, and just asking what the guidelines are in having claims reprocessed where DHS makes the retroactive change to a CP amount, sometimes 6 months or more in arrears. When they submit their reconsideration, it's denied for timely filing. Is the reconsideration the what should be done for a retroactive CP change, or what would be the proper tool to get that resolved?
This is Cherie. So it depends on what, you know, what's the circumstance. If they're owed money, to be honest, I'm not really sure, because the retroactive, you know, would come through. If they've billed, if the claim is not billed correctly, though, with the correct amount of CP client participation on the claim, then it's going to require a corrected claim.
Okay.
So if it's retro, and so I don't know the difference. I don't want to speak out of turn and, you know, like say something that's not accurate, but I do know that we just did a big project. I'm not even sure that it's fully complete at this point in time, but I know that that was related to, you know, that there had been a backlog, you know, related to COVID and other things with doing the, you know, getting the client participation stuff, because they weren't requiring reporting on some of this stuff for a period of time due to COVID. So I know we retro reported, but the claim would have to be a correct claim, meaning, you know, what the CP amount is. And then, you know, and then we would adjust the claim. You know, we don't have to take back what was paid and then pay the whole thing again. We would just adjust and pay the offset.
Thanks, Cherie. I mean, we submit a CP amount on our claim based off of the information we have from the department at the time. Is that, I assume that that's verified within Amerigroup system, because there you guys are given CP update information, I would guess, at least monthly, if not daily or weekly. So are those two amounts, I guess, verified with one another? And I guess that was the reason for the question, is it possible, I think it is, to just reprocess those when you have retroactive CPs come in that you know require a claim to be adjusted?
Right. I think that that's something that, to be accurate, I'll need to take that back and, you know, to clarify. I actually did just pull up a bunch of information off of the IME website about client participation the other day. So I will forward that to you, Brandon, because I think it's very informational. And then I'll clarify that piece on the billing. You know, the standard comment would be that, you know, the claim should reflect what we're paying and we can't pay for something that we haven't been billed for. However, we did do the reprocessing project. So I just want to clarify, you know, what things will be like going forward. And I do want to just comment that, you know, there, even when there's not COVID and so on, I think that was part of the question, is sometimes those retroactive client participation changes, you know, come 6 months later. And so I get how frustrating it could be, because it is a very delayed process, and wish there was something better, but, you know, it's dependent upon getting information, you know, from a member and, you know, being able to get the member stuff through the process. But we get the information as a download from the state, so then we update our systems.
Right. Okay. Janet, did you have something you wanted to add?
I do. So would it be better for us as a provider to not put the client participation amount on the UB04? Therefore, we don't have to go back and do six or seven corrected claims?
I would not advise that, because then the claim you could run in the potential that you'll have like lots of claims that are overpaid, and then you have rework on overpayments.
I would agree with that, Sheree. I think that would be the experience that you may have, is it not being deducted at all.
Okay. Thank you.
I know we're running at our end of our hour. A couple of questions I saw come in related to cost containment or recoupment requests, and we've submitted responses. A couple back in November, I know two different providers have submitted those back in November, and they still haven't received any response or confirmation, I suppose. I think I've heard that before, where you'll submit your information and then you'll just never hear anything back, whether it's been approved or denied. So I guess the question is, what kind of time frame are we expecting for those dispute projects to be completed if we're submitting all of our information into cost containment? I know we probably don't have anyone from cost containment on the call, and I don't know if it's, I know we've asked this before, and I don't know if it's possible to have anyone from cost containment participate, but the cost containment unit process is, it feels very disjointed for providers, because of that reason. You'll follow the process, you'll submit the information, then you'll hear nothing back, whether it's been okayed as, yep, we agree, recoupment stops, or you'll find out, you know, in 3 months when the money is just taken back anyways, and you have no idea why. And so I don't know if there's any thoughts or comments on that.
Okay, Brandon, this is Sheree. So I'm going to have to clarify one piece of information, but it's either a 90-day window or a 120-day window. And I think it's 90, but I'm going to clarify that, of when they send out those letters, from the date of the letter, that they're going to, you know, if it's not resolved within that time frame, that they're going to recoup. So if a provider sends stuff in and is approaching that deadline and hasn't heard anything from the recoupment team, then the best thing to do is reach out to their rep. And then again, the rep can, you know, utilize the CCU inquiry, you know, our emails, our electronic system to communicate with them. And so you just want to make sure, the easiest thing is to just provide a copy of the letter. You know, you don't have to send all, you know, claims and everything to the rep. They just need to be able to have those project numbers, and then they can reach out and say, hey, this provider hasn't heard anything. What's the status? And then again, you know, if you have questions about your recoupment status, you know, your rep can go through that process with you and, you know, help you to determine, is a corrected claim needed, you know, or is some other action needed, you know, to be able to save that payment.
Awesome. Thank you. And then the last comment that I see is about the HIPS code. And it sounds like they're being rejected, at least for this provider. And so there's not a way to have them be reconsidered because they're not able to be received, I suppose. Does that make sense?
It does. And so this is one that I'm going to give you general information, but they really are going to need to reach out to their rep because there's two different types of rejection. And I don't know which rejection is on, you know, this set of this type of a claim. So one set of rejections, we actually have claim numbers, meaning they made it into our system, but then were rejected. But there's another type of rejection that they're rejected before they even hit our system. And so the ones that actually hit our system, we can queue those, you know, if it's an error and their stuff needs to be corrected, but you would not do that through the dispute process. You would do that through your, you know, your provider rep. And then if we're not able to requeue them because they're outside of the system, they would have to be resubmitted, but you would want to work with your rep and have the rep help you to make sure to get to the root cause of why they're being, you know, rejected. Because if you're not, you don't have that root cause identified, then, you know, your rejections, well, you're going to submit them again and they're going to reject again. And so there is a project on that subject matter, but I would take your specifics and go to your rep. And then let's see, there was one more question that I just wanted to quickly answer that was in there that we haven't covered. And someone had inquired, can you see the network rows, you know, like in Availity or something? The network rows are something that we see, but what you can do is find out what your active provider numbers are from your rep. And if you know what your active provider numbers are, you can see in Availity and see that things are matching up on that, how I was talking about the network rows.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Appreciate all the questions that came through the chat and those submitted ahead of time. Thanks again to Myra Group for participating in our call, staying with us a little bit longer today to make sure we got to all the questions. And then lastly, want to thank again Right Dose Pharmacy for sponsoring our calls. You know, a great partner, like I said, of the association. We look forward and continue working with them as we move forward. And if you have any pharmacy related needs, that could be a good avenue to check out for you. Again, thanks everyone for joining us. We'll be back again next month. And as always, feel free to submit me questions ahead of time or at any time over the next course of the next month, and we can see if we can help you get some answers. So everyone have a good rest of the week. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.